I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1992, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1992 here from our perch in 2023. I'm one of your hosts, Phil Lesko.
And I am your special guest host, Emily St. James, sitting in for your normal host. We're going to circle back to it.
It's going
to
be great.
We're going to put
great.
It at the end.
It's going to be great. Whatever it is, it's going to be wonderful. But with
it's
us today
so good.
Is our writer directors, Harry Alphont and Deborah Kaplan. Thank you so much for coming on to talk with us today about Wayne's World, a pretty seismic comedy from 1992 that made a pretty staggering amount of money back in the day. But I wanted to have you guys on for obvious reasons, which is that you guys are obviously wonderful writer directors. But I felt like, and we talked about this a little bit before we were on mic, that maybe this was an influential film for you guys. But it seems like maybe it was subconsciously, but possibly not really.
First of all, thanks for having us on. It's a pleasure. The truth is, you're linking the DNA to Josie and Pussycats, mm-hmm. It's been so long. I don't really remember talking a lot about Wayne's World when we were talking about Josie. The two references I remember mm-hmm. were we talked about like kind of the tone of like a live action Simpsons episode. This is when like the Simpsons was in its
sure.
heyday, 2000.
Sure.
Still is in my house.
and we talked about Fight Club. Just kind of the satirical
oh, wow.
nature of, you know, how Fight Club looked at consumerism and all
obviously
of that.
You can see the parallels.
Yeah, I mean, they're obviously there.
So clear.
And we talked about Austin Powers in terms of tone, in terms of like the villains
sense.
And that.
Sure.
We didn't talk about Wayne's World. I mean, I think the scene that to me makes the most sense is the
product placement
scene.
Yeah.
And I think that was just always, I don't know, I kind of always remembered that scene, but it wasn't like, hey, let's do a movie like that. Let's that scene, but the whole movie. Like, I don't remember us ever saying that.
Yeah, I mean, the it's interesting you bring up Fight Club, because I do think that Josie and to a certain degree Wayne's World, the metatextuality of sort of what kind of came in the wake of a movie like Wayne's World. Like, I watched it, Emily, you've seen Wayne's World, right?
This is like, you know how I never have nostalgia for any of the movies we cover? This one I've seen like 7 times. I knew this movie. This movie's in my like lingua franca. I just like have quotes I do from it. I didn't even realize
sure.
we're from Wayne's World because I probably haven't watched it since I was 16.
Right.
And it is just, yeah, it just watching it was like having a weird like return to my past. Like my wife was quoting every single line because she
yeah.
like her little brother was peak Wayne's World age, so like But yeah, it just, I really think the way that this used Breaks the Fourth Wall was like just hugely influential for me. Yeah, I love that kind of stuff. There's a joke in Barbie that feels very Wayne's World and how it breaks the fourth wall, and that was like my favorite part of the movie. So
which one?
Which was the joke?
It's at this.
Is it the narration?
It's when Helen Mirren pops in over an emotional scene about how beautiful Barbie is to make comments about Margot Robbie directly, and I was like, ha ha, yes, Margot Robbie is a beautiful human. Thank you.
It was pretty great.
I do think that, and I'm sure that our listeners will think of some other film, and I'm sure there's many films before Wayne's World, but I do feel like it was pretty groundbreaking in terms of how it sort of, obviously its birth is in sketch comedy. So there's a lot of kind of scenes that feel kind of sketchy, I guess, to some degree or another, but it's not a plotty movie, right? Like it has like a coat hanger of a plot. And then it's really just almost just a whole bunch of non sequiturs that kind of connect to one another. This is all just to say, like, this movie shouldn't work. Like, on paper, this movie shouldn't work. And we'll talk about the somewhat tumultuous production of this film, which was its own thing. But I do feel like it was pretty groundbreaking in terms of, at least for me as a 12-year-old, I felt like I was watching something that kind of changed the way I saw comedy. And I think a generation of writers and directors took a lot of stuff away from it. I mean, as Emily just said, I think that you can see shades of it in Barbie, but I guess sort of the metatextual stuff that you were talking about, like Fight Club is that dialed up to 11, right? And as the 90s progress, you see more and more of that. And then obviously with your film Josie, that was sort of a way of coming at it as well. Do you think that, like, on some level, were you guys thinking about that metatext? Was the commentary on sort of the layeredness of how all these movies have become so layered? And do you sort of see what I'm saying?
I mean, look, we definitely knew we wanted the movie to have a meta layer. I don't even know if we used the word meta back then. That's how long ago it was.
It might not have existed.
Yeah, I don't know anybody called things meta. But we definitely, look, you know, we have... in my opinion, maybe one too many fourth wall breaks, Josie. But you know, just the you know, I'm here because I'm on the comic book. You know, we definitely knew in the you know, the subliminal messages and all of that. That was fun. You know, it was really more, what do we want to have be kind of fun? What do we think is funny? With that was really the driver, I think.
I mean, I guess it's also, it is funny, and I feel like we'll talk about, I think Barbie is going to come up to some degree or another just in terms of the IP-ness of everything. Like, technically speaking, Wayne's World is IP. It is a sketch that has turned into a movie, and Josie obviously was a comic book and then I believe an animated show. Am I making that up?
Yeah.
No, I remember the animated show because I was not a big comics or Archie comics reader. So when they approached us...
I was a big comic reader.
But when they approached us with Josie, I remembered the Saturday morning cartoon. That was my reference point.
Pussycat in Outer Space, wasn't it?
Well, first it was Josie and the Pussycat. Then it was Josie and the Pussycat in Outer Space. When everything went to outer space. Yeah, that's the one I remembered.
I didn't know. Josie and the Pussycat in Outer Space. Did you read the comics? I'm assuming you did.
I knew Archie comics.
Okay.
Josie, I was is less familiar with. It was like a tangent, but I knew like who they were. You know.
Sure.
When they announced the movie in whatever year that was announced, I was like, oh, they're making a Josie and the Pussycats movie. And like everyone around me was like, what? Cause like, we were all just like too young to know the cartoon. Sure. But I like read Archie comics cause my grandparents had a giant box of them for some reason. I don't know. Nothing about my childhood makes sense. Let's just move on.
but I do think that the, you know, it's funny cause the Archie thing, I read Archie comics as a kid. It felt like whenever I was in a supermarket with my mom or whatever, I'd essentially force her to buy me one. And I remember reading them, and Josie, you know, features pretty prominently in them. It's kind of amazing how long it took for us to get to like Riverdale, for instance. Like, it's kind of amazing that it took as long as it did, considering how huge those comics were. But so you guys rewatched Wayne's World for this podcast, which I am very thankful you took the time to do. How did it speak to you guys in 2023 versus when you saw it in, I guess, 1992?
You know, I I want to say there was like a large degree of cynicism watching it back because we really were looking actively at the structure. And, you know, the first thing we said was like, okay, so what does he want in this movie? Like, I mean, initially, it just seems like all he wants is this guitar. And they fulfill that want kind of even halfway into the movie. Yeah. And it's sort of anticlimactic. He just comes in and says, I'm going to buy it today. Yeah. And then I guess he wants the girl.
Sure.
But then we also could not figure out what Rob Lowe was trying to do for the longest time. We're like, what is his objective? It does not make any sense. Whereas I think, you know, I'm just going to say how old I am. Like, you were 12. I was 22 when that movie came out.
Sure.
I think that didn't even occur to me. Like how, but we did. When was that when we had that meeting with Mike Myers?
We met with Mike Myers. It was a long time ago. I think it may have been pre Austin Powers. That's how long ago it was.
No.
I think so.
No.
All right.
Austin Powers is 98, right?
No,
97.
Oh, I think it 97. May have been. I think it may have been before that. Really? I don't think we had done Can't Hardly Wait before that. Mike Myers.
Wanted to remake The Court Jester.
Oh, I thought it was Walter Mitty.
We did not meet on Walter Mitty. Maybe you did. Harry's the keeper of the vault.
It was a Danny Kaye movie. Yeah. We know it was a Danny Kaye movie. Yeah. I don't remember being The Court Jester, but maybe it was. I feel like it was Walter Mitty because that's been in development for a while. But anyway.
Yes, so you met with him about this, and this is prior to Can't Hardly Wait that you meet with him on this.
I believe Harry.
But she says no, it's impossible. Let's just say it was sometime 20 plus years ago.
Okay.
What was your takeaway?
He explained the real estate of the comedy to us. He's a very serious guy. There were not a lot of laughs in the meeting. And it was, I don't remember if he had a board.
No, he didn't have a board.
The way I remember it, there was like a whiteboard. With a map on it, but okay.
I think you're thinking of him in Inglourious Basterds.
For purposes of the story, there is a wife.
So,
sure,
perfect. Love it.
But I will say, though, having now had, you know, 20 plus years of experience, he wasn't wrong. Because his theory of the real estate of comedy was the first half of the movie, you can just do joke, 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 joke. You can do as many jokes as you want. But the second half, the story has to take over. Because if you start doing just like bits to just like do a sidetrack and do just a bit for a bit's sake, the audience is going to get impatient. So it's like, let's get back to the story. And we talked about it because the opening of the movie is just, you know, it's just all bits. Yes. I mean, the truth is. Most of the movie is all bit.
Yeah, he didn't quite follow the rule. Right. Like, if you really look at it carefully, like, there are a lot of bits in the back half of the film, too. But when you, a couple minutes into the movie, are doing that Bohemian Rhapsody scene, which is, I think, one of the things people remember most about the movie, it has no purpose except to get you to the guitar store so he can say, it will be mine. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's the thing everybody enjoys the most.
I forgot how early that came. In my memory...
Yeah.
It's the first scene. Essentially, it's the first scene.
I'm not sure the credits are done by that
point. No, they're not. My memory was that happened midway through. You know, there's story. And then midway through, there was the big Bohemian Rhapsody scene that everybody loved. But I'm like, oh, it's the beginning of the movie. So interesting.
I don't know if that is actually so interesting. No, it absolutely is. I think it's, you know, I have not watched this film in a while. I own it. It's just I had an urge to watch it. And then I knew we were going to cover it. So I kind of waited. And I was, first of all, I couldn't believe how much I know from this movie. Like, it was just, it's hardwired in my brain. But also being critical of it and like actually watching it like the four of us did in terms of, you know, what it's trying to do. It's amazing how little it's trying to do, like how effortless it is in terms of just kind of just doing a bunch of stuff. There's jokes in it that, I mean, the Great Poupon joke does not work anymore because no one knows what the fuck it's
hilarious.
Yeah, the whole Laverne and Shirley sequence.
Yeah, there's jokes in it where you're just like, okay, I imagine that my mom probably saw this film with me and loved the Laverne and Shirley joke. Like, that's a joke literally for the parents.
I bet the Laverne and Shirley joke, because I'm a little older than Deb, so I think the Laverne and Shirley joke killed because it came out of nowhere and it was still, I mean, every single person in the audience, that theater, yep. That was just in there. But I mean, I still get nostalgic hearing the song. So it just, that I'm sure it killed. I remember seeing the sketch, the first time seeing the sketch. I was in college, I think, when that started. And I remember being with some friends and it was the last sketch on. It was like the 10-to-1 sketch. They buried it. And we all were like, okay, what is this? Because this is hilarious. Because it seemed so different than anything else that was on the show. And then I think the story is like, And then the next time it was on, it was the first sketch after, you know, the monologue, because it was so popular and then it took off. But
it is kind of interesting how, so I guess, I mean, from the research that I did, Mike Myers had this idea for a guy who had a cable access television show. And he did not want Dana Carvey in the sketch with him.
No, he had done it before. From what I read, right. He had actually done the character.
Like the Second City. Yeah,
yeah, before yeah. He got to SNL. But then he did the math of like, well, if you want to get a sketch on, yep. Put the biggest star on the show in it. So he created Garth, and then yeah. that was not.
And resented it every yeah, day
yeah.
after.
Yeah. And you can see in the movie that, I mean, it's so weird too, because we looked up there, you know, Dana Carvey's, you know, a decent amount older than Mike Myers. And it's almost like Dana Carvey's born in 1955. So he's kind of the tail end of the baby boomers. Sure. Mike Myers is like early 60s. So he's kind of like about Gen X. It's like, they really are kind of different generations. You feel absolutely. That in the comedy.
They're siloed off a lot too. And, yeah. and you, which you don't notice as you're watching the film, and they are a great duo, right? Like I would argue they're one of the great duos in terms of, you know, your Bill and Ted's, your whoever's of that kind of oeuvre. And I do think that Dana's stuff feels a lot more kind of improvisational and a lot kind of, it has a crackle to it. Whereas I think that the Mike Myers stuff feels very kind of written and specific and knows what he wants to be doing. They're kind of doing different things, and yet they complement each other. It's when you read about the stuff of whenever Dana would do something that improvise something that worked, Mike would be pissed and would want to cut from the movie. Like it's kind of insane. But I mean,
but
I think
it also
he's just
felt like they were struggling to come up with, okay, what's Garth's story going to be? Because like he starts MacGyvering stuff together, and it yep. felt like, okay, what
he's
is this?
He's in love with Donna Dixon.
Right, yes. Who has maybe one line in the movie.
I'm not sure she does.
I'm not sure she even has a line.
Wow.
But
yeah.
She does Carvey say, also gets really
I love you, Garth, I think, at
yeah,
the end.
She does yeah. say, I love you, Garth.
I think so. Yeah.
Also seems like Dana Carvey gets relegated to sort of a more vintage style of comedy. You know, he's got like the big slapstick bits. There's like a lot of undercranked footage that like, mm-hmm. It's so bizarre. I forgot that it was yeah. in there. It's like a Gilligan's Island
totally.
Episode.
He's either like slowed down or sped up. He's yeah. like thrown against walls. It's the drum solo thing is actually Dana Carvey. He actually knows how to play the drums. It's just, and it's funny because watching it this time, Garth was kind of the MVP for me this time around. Like his stuff really popped in a way that, I agree, he has no arc. He has no mission or any desires, it seems. But I just really kind of, he spoke to me this time. I don't know. Emily, Garth, did he speak to you?
Garth is always my fave. He was, as a teenager, Garth sure. was, Garth and Cassandra were my favorites sure. as a teenager. Because Cassandra is so cool and so She's hot. So cool. And I was yep. like, I should be her. Someday,
yeah.
yeah.
I should be in a metal band. Yeah.
The MVP for me, what I completely forgot about, was Ed O'Neill.
Oh my god, he's so
yeah, he's so good.
Oh my, I completely forgot he was in the movie, and I was like, oh, he's. I want more of Ed O'Neill.
Everything he does holds up. Like all the comedy that he does in that movie is still funny. Nothing seems out of place.
His monologue at the beginning is unbelievable.
What I love about him is he also they use him to establish the rules of the movie. Because like when he comes in and starts talking into the camera, you're like, is this movie just going to be complete anarchy? And then I think it's Wayne.
Wayne
like,
comes
no,
back. Yeah, yeah, yeah,
you
yeah.
don't get to talk to the camera. So like Wayne knows there's a camera there, mm-hmm. but the other characters don't get to know. And from then on, that yeah. that rule holds.
It's only and Wayne and Garth that get
only
to talk
Wayne
to the
and
camera.
Garth. Yeah, yeah.
Which is kind of amazing. I do think I why did this come up before, Emily? I can't remember what movie it was that we talked about fourth wall breakage before. There was some other film that it happened, and I can't remember what it was, but it doesn't matter. My point is, I think generally speaking, fourth wall stuff makes me cringe. It doesn't generally work. I think it's a very hard needle to thread, but this movie
people
doesn't.
People say this.
Yes.
I don't think it's like I have never felt that way about a fourth
really?
Wall break.
Says the person with the Fleabag poster.
Exactly. Yeah.
exactly.
Yeah.
Does work there and works in that one moment in Trading Places where Eddie Murphy looks right at the camera. I yeah. still remember
sure.
that.
Like, and it also works in, problematic movie, sure. but 16 Candles totally works.
When and Ferris Bueller.
Yeah.
Ferris Bueller, he talks
well,
to the camera.
Ferris Bueller, that's, yeah.
I mean, I don't mean to suggest that that it can't work or that it hasn't worked a lot of the time. I think that the one that jumps out at me is the first season of Sex and the City, where I just was like, I don't like this. And then it just turns it to VO, which is the way that it should have been, obviously. I think we talked about, Emily, the voiceover versus fourth wall breakage at some point.
Yeah.
And I do appreciate that this movie goes right at it. Like, Wayne is talking to the camera in the first like 30 seconds of the movie, it feels like.
I think, yeah. And I think the thing that, as someone who works a lot in this space, just across various projects, like the thing you need to have is rules on when the VO comes in or when the fourth wall break happens. Sure. And like that lets the audience feel comfortable around the idea of, because like the breaking of the fourth wall has existed as like it's arguably older than not breaking the fourth wall. If you look at like Greek, Greek dramas had like people who just came and were like, this is the story you are watching. Hello, audience. Welcome. We are going to hear about a guy who kills his dad and marries his mom. Doesn't that sound fun? And, you know, like comics, as we talked about, have a lot of that. Like, this is just very much in the DNA. And I think when I watch Wayne's World, I know how much Mike Myers loves movies from the 40s. This movie has a lot in common with the Marx Brothers in a lot of ways. Like, the fact that it's just bits, especially, and that, like, what story there is kind of comes in toward the end, but not really. And that there's this totally superfluous love story it's all so Marx Brothers, but the Marx Brothers loved playing around with the idea of the audience is watching us and how can we play around.
I think
with
there's
that.
Ebert reviews refers to this in his review, but I do think there is sort of a Zucker and Abrams kind of component to this as well, because, you know, we are in the post top secret, you know, airplane era, which is in the 80s, and obviously we're in the early 90s with Wayne's World. I think that there's it's very much a pastiche of a bunch of things that are all bouncing against each other, which is why I sort of understand why Paramount seemed a little unsure as to what to do with this movie. I mean, there was a teaser trailer, which I remember seeing in the theater that I rewatched, where they're inside the Addams Family. Do you remember this by any chance?
Oh,
so the Addams Family had just come out, I believe, in 90 or maybe 91. And so Paramount, in this sort of cross-pollination of it all, did a teaser where Wayne and Garth are in the cemetery of the Addams Family. And they're like doing the whole snapping their fingers and doing the whatever. And then they're like, oh, and we're making a movie and it's coming out next. Like, it totally cross purposes. Like, I don't understand how these.
This is crazy because Addams Family comes out early November 1991. Okay. Wayne's World comes out Valentine's Day 92. So like, that is such a like, this bizarre. Is how we're launching our campaign for this movie.
It's so strange that someone at Paramount was like, well, these two things speak to each other, right? Like, they don't in any real way. But it was sort of fascinating to me to watch this moment of marketing where they're just like, how do we market this movie? Like, what is Paramount?
I mean, I will say Paramount at the time was marketing like so many more movies than they do now. It was like, all right, what are we going to do with this? Fine, we'll do Addams Family. Who knows? I mean, it was just, you know, and who they probably had super low expectations. They did not expect the monster hit.
No, I mean, I'll just to give a little bit of context in terms of a synopsis. This is a big screen spinoff of the Saturday Night Live sketch. Rob Lowe plays a producer who wants to take this public access show, Wayne's World, to the world.
I'm just going to say, speaking of Barbie, yes, Rob Lowe's job is executive.
Yes. Yeah. And evil executive.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
Just,
yes.
Yeah. Just unsure of what his motives are. But
I still don't know.
I think it's to appease Brian Doyle Murray, right?
But he has such a but it was his idea. Literally, it's his idea to like, okay, I'm going to sell this guy on selling ads on a show that I have to then sell them on the ad. And there's also zero pressure on him to do it. Like, why?
I don't know who his boss is.
No, he just has an idea and he wants to see it through because it's
pretty
so
amazing.
Funny.
It's pretty amazing. He's just this kind of like we're introduced to him. In the first scene of this movie is him and Ione Skye, who I completely forgot was in this movie. And they're watching TV in bed, having gone to Sharky's for pizza. Because she works as a waitress at Sharky's, which is insane. Like, everything about this, like, this is how the movie starts. And then she essentially introduces him to this late-night cable show, which is Wayne's World. And he has this light bulb idea to fold these two things together. But like, that's it, right? And he's successful in doing that.
Yeah.
And by the way, like at the end, none of this changes anything, right? Like, does he lose at the end?
The only thing he seems to really lose is Cassandra.
He loses because which I don't even know if he wants to corrupt. He doesn't get to corrupt the show. Wayne doesn't sell out. It's clear, like, they're not going to do the big studio version of Wayne's World. So in that way, yes, he loses. What he loses, I don't know. I mean, look, I don't want to sound like a studio executive. You're like, why? What are his motivations? And we could be more clear. Sure. But I was actually asking these questions when we were watching the movie.
It does make you sort of, again, as we've been doing this podcast, we've been doing now for, you know, 6 months or so, we've covered probably 40 movies from 1992. And it was a different time, as we can all attest. I think audiences were a lot less cynical. They were probably expecting less from movies. They weren't as sort of, you know, putting things under microscopes like we are now, which is why I think Barbie is such a miracle of a movie in its own right, because it feels like a thing that we don't do anymore, which is just like have fun and just like go to the movies, and there can be really interesting ideas in there. And this movie, which comes out, as Emily mentioned, on Valentine's Day 1992, it opens up against Medicine Man, Fried Green Tomatoes, The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, Final Analysis. These are the movies that are out in February of 1992.
Just remember, like, every weekend there were like three new movies to choose from.
Yeah.
Somebody tweeted a list recently. Sorry to digress. Somebody tweeted a list of like that's their top movies of like 1995, and then listed all of the other movies. And I realized, oh my god, I saw all of these in the theater, and it was like hundreds. Not like hundreds. Of movies. I mean, that's what you did. I would go multiple times a week.
We did with my previous co-host, Kenny and I did 1999. For 5.5 years, we did that podcast, covered every movie that came out in 1999.
Wow.
And it's in the vicinity of like 320 movies, give or take. I mean, it's around there. That's how many movies came out then. And the spectrum of it is just crazy. So it is sort of this, you know, 1992, looking at this particular weekend, right? And the spectrum of what is available to you, right? Where you could go to see, you know, Hand That Rocks the Cradle or Wayne's World. I mean, that is, it's pretty crazy. This movie goes on to make $183 million on a $20 million budget in 1992 dollars. So you can, you know, imagine that's probably 350, 400 now, something in that vicinity. It's an enormous hit. It's the biggest SNL movie that's ever been, really. Blues Brothers gives it, I guess, a run for its money, but still, like, those are the two big ones. And it creates a whole host of SNL sketch movies that come out in its wake. It has 79% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 84% from audiences. The movie's still like this beloved classic of a film. But I do wonder what anyone expected from this movie when it came out. Like, I just don't even know. I guess it was for the SNL kids, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, I mean,
I was very surprised to find out this was the second SNL movie. That Blues Brothers comes out in 80 or 81, and then this movie takes, then it takes them 12 years to get to this, and then they just make 17
million.
I dated a girl who saw Night at the Roxbury three nights in a row, so that's
that feels that like was, a
she dragged me
something.
She dragged me one of those showings because she was like,
did you like it,
Chris? It's fine. I don't remember anything about it. She thought Chris Kattan was super hot, and I was like, "That's a weird crush to have." But
that's
interesting.
It's. I mean, I think ultimately what happens with this is that they realize obviously that these SNL movies are very low overhead. They can bang them out really quickly. They're super cheap, and you know they'll make their money back. Like they just seem like easy bets, but nothing is like this. And then there's a sequel to this movie, which doesn't do nearly as well, which Penelope Spheeris was told she could not direct by Mike Myers.
I looked into that movie. Yeah. I just was reading about it. I read the Wikipedia page. Sure. They were going to base it on a movie. Like Mike Myers was like, here's a movie. He just started like rewriting this movie. Something like Pimlico was the name of it. And it's about these people forming their own country. And Wayne's World 2 was going to be about Wayne and Garth forming their own country. And then right as they were getting into production, Paramount found out it was based on a movie they didn't own the rights to and hadn't purchased the adaptation rights to. And they were like, you cannot make this movie because we didn't know about this. And that is absolutely a thing that would happen to me. I would be like, oh, we don't own the rights to Hamlet. What?
I do want to give a shout out to Bonnie and Terry Turner, who are a husband and wife writing team who co-wrote this film and co-wrote the second film. They would go on to create Third Rock from the Sun and That 70s Show. So they're doing very well for themselves. Yes, yes.
But if you want to know, my point is just if you want to know why Wayne's World 2 feels completely unstructured, that's because they wrote a script in like 3 weeks.
They could do it.
So they could make it.
It feels... So I saw Wayne's World 2. I remember I saw it when it came out. It came out almost a year to the day. Like they basically just...
Oh, it came out in December 1993. It was
okay,
like...
So it's a year and a half later. Okay.
Yeah, it's almost 2 years. Yeah, but it is
it's
very
fast.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just remembered the Jurassic Park joke, which felt kind of like it all just felt kind of too pop culture-y for its own good. Like the thing about the first Wayne's World movie is that the pop culture references that it's making all felt somewhat older, right?
We kind of zoomed right past this earlier talking about the Laverne and Shirley thing, but I think the reason this all works and like the humor about women being hot or kind of some of the gags that play off cultural stereotypes. The reason I think most of them still work, including the pop culture references, is that they are just as much jokes about Wayne and Garth, that they are going to like stop their like visit to Milwaukee to do where they have this very important thing to do, to go to this concert of this guy they love, to do a Laverne and Shirley riff. And that gives you a sense of who they are. Cause like the pop culture gags are not just like they are Zaz, Zucker Abrams sort of adjacent, but they're very rooted in, oh, this is just a thing that like my friends and I might do. You know, if we're out driving around at night and we see an old guy in his car, we might do a Grey Poupon thing. It is like, it is kind of like that thing of like comedy is often about like giving voice to our worst impulses. Sure. This is a bad impulse I have. I always want to make inappropriate pop culture references. And Wayne and Garth actually do it. They just go out there.
They get to live our fantasy.
They get to live our fantasy of reenacting the Laverne and Shirley opening title.
But it's, I mean, even there's, they go to the Alice Cooper concert and then as they go back to the studio to record the show, they're like, oh, we almost missed recording our first episode because we were so enamored with Alice Cooper. They really do have this. I mean, they're clearly supposed to be teenagers. Are we like, I mean, how old are they supposed to be?
It's unclear. Like, I remember thinking back in the day, like they were a little too old to play those parts. But watching it now, Mike Myers is still, he's sort of baby faced. Yeah. Dana Carvey has like full on wrinkles.
Absolutely.
Like when they cut to those close up, I'm like, whoa. Like, I almost feel like it was cruel. Like they didn't filter him or something. They just went
it. Yeah.
How old are they supposed to be, Emily? Like 20?
I would guess between 20 and 25. Because it is considered like very shameful that he lives with his parents, which if he was 17 would not be the case. I'm guessing he's somewhere in his mid 20s,
Makes sense.
That makes sense. They're going they're going to concerts. Although I don't know if we see them drinking. We might. I don't know. But I know what you're saying. It's definitely they feel kind of older. I mean, they're certainly not as old as they actually are. I think that Mike Myers and Tia Carrere actually have a great chemistry. Like I think that she's really good in this movie. And I would argue I'm not sure that she's given the career that she should have had coming out of this movie, because she's really funny. She's very charismatic. She's awesome. She's way out of Wayne's league. Like she seems so completely out of he's punching way out of his weight class. I'm amazed she gives him the time of day, but I mean, I guess that's part of the fantasy.
He is a television star, Phil, and that makes up for
a lot. She doesn't know that. I don't know that she knows that when she meets him.
Well, listen, between when she meets him and when they talk the second time, which is on the same night, somebody pulls up an episode of Wayne's World on YouTube on their phone and is like, look at this. This guy's
true. Yeah.
Somebody pulls out a VCR that they're carrying around and pops in a tape that they recorded. Back to the Turners, we have one Bonnie and Terry Turner story, which is we had a meeting somewhat early in our career with a director who was talking to us about various things. And at a certain point,
he had called us for the meeting.
Yeah.
It was like very important that this man wanted to meet with us. And we were really sort of like, we can't believe he knows who we are.
And then he mentioned that the reason he wanted to meet with us is because James L. Brooks told him that we were terrific. And we were like, holy shit, James L. Brooks knows who we are? This is insane. And then it becomes more and more clear that we are not the people he thinks we are, because he thinks we are Bonnie and Terry Turner. Because they wrote the first Brady Bunch movie and we wrote the second Brady Bunch movie, and he got that confused, and it was crushing to realize, oh, this was all a big mistake and we left.
I mean, I guess a man and woman writing team. Yeah. I mean, I
Brady,
guess that's
man
all.
Man and woman writing team.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
Jim
that's
Brooks,
still
if you're
not
out there.
Okay.
We're still here.
I just want to say
I've seen him on the picket lines, for what that's worth.
I just want to say, very Brady sequel. I actually slightly prefer to the first Brady Bunch movie.
There you go.
I don't know how much of that's you guys, but yeah.
Thanks. Good work. Appreciate it. We went, we kind of went a little farther with it.
That is another kind of, it feels like, when are the Brady Bunch movies? They're in the mid 90s, right?
Yeah, I think the Brady sequel came out in 96, I want to say. And the first one was like, probably 94. But they definitely feel a similar tone. Like, I don't know that those movies get made without Wayne's World.
That's sort of what I was going to... Like, it feels like Wayne's World also creates that offshoot of the boomer TV shows turned into movies thing. Which also they... And then literally Penelope Spheeris goes on to direct the Beverly Hillbillies, unfortunately.
Well, that's such a Gen X thing, because all these, you know, Brady Bunch was like mostly popular with the kids of the baby boomers who like watched it endlessly in reruns. And that's just like Gen X is this generation of people raised by television in a certain way where like there's just constant reruns and they're just like so conversant with old television, old movies. Like you see that in how Mike Myers approaches telling these stories. So I do think there's this brief window when Gen X is the cool people, which we're talking about in 1992, weirdly.
We have a moment.
Yeah. Listen, as an elder millennial, I'm watching my moment slip away from me. So,
yeah.
But I do think that these movies are so clearly influenced by the beats of television as well, of the structure of them, the joke a minute thing of just keeping people laughing. So, you know, story is kind of secondary to just making sure that there's a good joke coming around the corner. I do think it's interesting that Lorne Michaels hires Penelope Spheeris to direct this film, having seen a bunch of her rock documentaries, which are incredible in their own right. I'm not sure that I totally understand how he gets from one to the other. It's not to say that she didn't do a great job. She did an incredible job directing this, but like, I guess there is a kind of rock and roll infusion in this film, you know, when it comes to the Alice Cooper stuff, when it comes to Wayne's desire to buy this guitar, to Cassandra being in a rock band. Like, there is a rock and roll thing. So maybe that's the connection, but they did not get along. For what it's worth, Mike Myers, as you guys mentioned, not a laugh a minute, seems like a very intense guy, seems like a pretty insecure guy, seemed a little petulant on set, would get very upset about margarine versus butter at Crafty and things like that. I don't know what to tell you. But he,
by the way, if they had margarine at Crafty instead of butter, I'm with them. Who the fuck wants margarine?
I mean, I agree with you.
It's the other way around, he's out of his mind.
It's terrible. Yeah, awful. Yeah. He threatened to leave the production when they wouldn't do Bohemian Rhapsody. I guess the studio wanted to do Welcome to the Jungle, the Guns N' Roses song. And he obviously pushed for Queen. Got it in there. It was a huge thing. It revives Queen. It basically brings them to a whole new generation. Freddie Mercury, who unfortunately passed before the movie came out, did get to see the scene, the Bohemian Rhapsody scene, before passing, and gave it his blessing.
It was my favorite scene of that movie. When Rami Malek watched the Wayne's World.
Don't even get me started.
Had tears
on
in his
movie.
Eyes. Oh, it was so moving.
You know, oh my God, that movie is just it's rough and made so much money. But what's interesting though is Mike Myers fights for Bohemian Rhapsody. They shoot this scene, and then unfortunately Mike Myers' father passes away shortly, like during post-production of the movie. Which is obviously very sad. But he then demands they cut it from the movie. He wants it cut from the film because he thinks it's not funny. And Penelope Spheeris, you know, puts her foot down and says, no, it needs to be in there. It's one, and it's obviously now arguably the most iconic scene from this film. I do think that part of, and again, I don't want to psychoanalyze Mike Myers because I don't know the man, but I'm just going to, based on what I've read here in terms of his frustrations with this film, I think is he knows this is his shot, right? Like he knows that if this doesn't work, it's his movie premiere. He's been in a movie before. I imagine there's a lot of insecurity, a lot of frustration, a lot of pressure that he's feeling. But then I also think if he's not getting the laugh, he doesn't know how to process that. Like, it seems that way.
From what we've read and heard, that feels accurate.
Yeah. So for what it's worth, I think, and I do think that, I think he's a genius. I don't mean to suggest that I don't think he's incredibly talented. I think that some people process their genius in other ways. Some people are able to actually like live with it, and other people seem to sort of fight against it in a weird way. But I think he's great in this film. Yeah.
There's something else that happens watching a movie with this kind of distance, which is, you know, it was so revolutionary at the time. And then all of the jokes get co-opted by people who just aren't funny and want to say schwing or not. And it's very hard to watch the movie and go back to remember when those were new and funny. Yep. It's, you know, it's happened with Borat.
Yeah, so that my wife, right. I don't even want to hear that from anyone anymore. Yeah.
So it's really hard to watch them do the schwing bits and think like, oh, this killed and was so funny because nobody had done it. When we've now have, you know, 30 years of people trying to make that funny.
I just want to say that my wife and schwing are still funny when done by lesbians. That's the one case in which, like,
by the way, everything's funnier when lesbians do it, though, is ultimately the truth. I mean, I'll say this, though. I agree with you, Harry. It's interesting. Like, there's so many not jokes in this. And I was like, I can't believe that not jokes were ever funny. Like, it's crazy to me that, I mean, I don't know. The jokes in this movie that work for me are, you know, I thought I had mono for a year. It turns out I was just really bored. It's things like that, like just hard jokes that I think are just funnier for me. I also think second MVP of this movie might be Lara Flynn Boyle.
Oh, God.
Yes. Yes.
Uh-oh. You're not a fan of Lara Flynn Boyle?
I did. I think I love Lara Flynn Boyle. You know, I love all Twin Peaks alums.
Sure.
But like, I heard you say that and I was like, yes, of course. Yes, I get it. No.
I'm sorry that I had a crush on Lara Flynn Boyle.
She's
when I was
very fun. Listen, Sherilyn Fenn all the way. But
see, I was more of a Lara Flynn. If I had to choose, and let's be honest, there was never really a choice for me, but Lara Flynn Boyle would have been
I think she's just really killing it in this movie. And I part of it is the commitment to the bit, a bit that, by the way, Mike Myers had to apologize to his ex-girlfriend about, because he had an ex-girlfriend who bought him a gun rack. Okay. I don't know her name was Stacy, but she bought him a gun rack, and she saw the movie later and he felt he needed to apologize for it. But the gun rack thing is great. That whole scene is great. Her wearing the Wayne necklace, the hey, Wayne, hey, and then just right into the car. I don't know. It's just that stuff is just, it really works for me. But Emily, it doesn't seem to be working for you.
I think it's very funny. I'm just more judging you than I am the character. No.
I'm shocked. I'm shocked that you would judge me under these circumstances. I think she's great in this. I think that this gave Rob Lowe a whole new lease on life in his career.
Well, we were talking about that. I mean, this was only a short time after his sex tape, which had it happened today, he would not recover. I mean, that girl was 16. Like, no one seems to ever talk about that. And it happened at a political convention. So.
Yeah, it had at the DNC. It's everything about it.
Extra creepy. And apparently what I had heard was like, they could get him cheap. You know, you look at what he was doing in that window on IMDb and like, it's not much.
No.
Masquerade. He had done Masquerade.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Which was a very like kind of Skinamax-y sort of softcore.
Totally. Movie. I think also this movie showed he could be funny, which was something that he didn't have in his.
And it wasn't even that he could be funny. It was that he could take his on-screen persona, still play it, and turn it 5 degrees to make it funny, which has just been the entire second half of his career, basically. Absolutely. You know, as soon as he lands Parks and Rec, that's just like all
it's hard
doing.
Not to see a lot of Parks and Rec in this performance too, like that he's sort of like, oh, I get it, people, like I can laugh at myself.
But first he went into West Wing, where like he became a dramatic actor again.
The
other casting thing is, we were because we completely forgot. We're watching and we're like, oh, who's Mr. Big? Who's the big guy at the end tapping his foot? We're like, who's this going to be? We're literally asking. I was like, let's think. It's 92. Like, you want Bill Murray, but Bill Murray you can't get.
Sure.
Maybe like Lauren calls Dan Aykroyd. I'm like, ooh, I think he says the Chicago thing. It totally needed Dan Aykroyd. And then it's some dude.
Some guy. Just some guy.
We looked up, was in Goodfellas. And also for a time was Michael Jackson's manager, but got fired for embezzling funds from Michael Jackson. That's what happened to that guy.
But why?
You know, the Goodfellas
thing,
isn't he the guy who? I think he's the guy who shoots Joe Pesci in Goodfellas.
Maybe. Not the guy that calls and tells him it's done.
As Harry said, like, why build it up with like we're just going to see his feet? Because wait till this guy steps out of the fucking limo, and then it's who?
it's no one. Yeah, I don't get it.
Because he's got a cigar, so he must be the guy in the limo.
It's pretty great.
The Scooby Doo ending. I was like, oh, now we're going to see the real guy. It's not like the schmo we've never seen before. It's going to be Dan Aykroyd now, and it was the same guy.
The Scooby-Doo ending is great because of the joke at the beginning, where he's like, how's the theme park or something?
The amusement park, yeah. How's the amusement park, yes. It seems like, wait, why is that in there? And then, yeah, definitely pays off.
It's fantastic. The Rob Lowe thing is fascinating because he does go back to drama. He, you know, notoriously turns down Grey's Anatomy, which, you know.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He was supposed to be Patrick Dempsey's character. Oh, it was apparently written for him, for what that's worth. But he turns that down and then ultimately does Parks and Rec and what have you. But Rob Lowe's career is a fascinating trajectory of choices, but. You know,
did you ever watch the show where he and his sons like chase aliens or ghosts or ghosts? They chase ghosts. It's a reality
is it on
show.
Right now?
No,
it's a reality show.
It lasted one season, and it was like he framed it as like, I just want to spend time with my sons, and the only way I know how is to make a reality show where we chase ghosts. It was like I don't know. I watch a lot of ghost reality shows. We're learning a lot about me right now. But like, it was one of the better because like they were having fun with it. And I don't know. I wish Rob Lowe. I wish honestly. I've heard he's very fun on 911 Lone Star. So I don't know.
Yeah,
what I'm saying,
I have friends who write on it and say he's lovely. Say he's a lot of fun to. So I mean,
bring back the Rob Lowe and his sons chase ghosts reality show.
I would be remiss if I didn't, as a Canadian, I need to point out the Canadian references that exist in this movie. Mike Myers is a very big, obviously he's Canadian. He's from Toronto or Scarborough. The hockey stuff is all references to obviously to Canada. Stan Makita is a Tim Hortons reference. Aurora, Illinois, there's Aurora, Ontario. There's a lot of kind of stuff that he's doing in there that I appreciate as a Canadian and makes me like the film even more. But it's stuff that like I just don't think means anything to anyone else. Like I think he's just kind of doing it for himself, it seems.
The game on thing is still funny. Them saying game on, and just like that,
it's
so
just
sweet and just feels. Because I mean, you don't have to have grown up in Canada to know what it's like to be playing on the street and suddenly get stopped.
But it's also like so many of the scenes as we mentioned earlier that feel like pointless. Like I love it, but like the only reason that scene exists is so that Garth can be like, should we trust Benjamin? Like that's basically it. And then it's just game on, game
on. Also, what a sort of more interesting way to do to get exposition across. Like, normally, be like, so what are they doing? They're walking, they're having coffee, they're just sitting around. Like, he framed it nicely with that hockey game, so you're not having a hard time swallowing exposition.
And it also gave you the pipe. He gives you Laughlin Boyle on the pipe, which I do remember getting a huge laugh.
It's great. It's a great joke.
We talked a little bit about Penelope Spheeris, but, like, I think she's genius at framing comedy. I think that, like, we just did a Sister Act episode where we talked about, like, how the comedy in that movie works, but the direction's a little anonymous.
Yeah.
And you really see the difference in a movie like this, where Penelope Spheeris knows how to frame a scene, even if it's just dialogue, so that the jokes hit with maximum impact. And when a joke is visual, she, like, does the perfect job of placing the camera so that the joke plays visually, which is, like, you know, a skill that, like, to return to Barbie, I think Greta Gerwig is also really good at that. It's a skill not a lot of people think about when they think about comedy direction, because we so often think about, like, comedy performers. And of course, the performance is so important, and getting that performance is a big part of directing. But yeah, I feel like the visual aspect of this movie is a little... It looks like, when you stack it right up against Sister Act, it's like a different world.
It's like Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
Do we know where they shot it? We were wondering, because some of it feels like L.A.
Most of it's L.A.
It is L.A., okay.
Yeah. They did some shots in Chicago, some in the Illinois area, obviously.
And there's a lot of tilts-up buildings. So many tilts-up buildings.
Yes. Like, anonymous buildings that could be really anywhere. I do think it's interesting, to your point, Emily, too, of sort of the little jokes that they find within scenes, where, like, when they go to the car shop, to get Wayne, I don't even know if it's Wayne or Garth's car, because they each drive it at different times. So you're
me and Ray Mike Myers did not know how to drive.
Oh, well, then that makes sense. Sure.
And they taught him how to drive for the movie. So maybe that's why. Maybe they just wanted to take some of the burden.
Probably for the Robert Patrick scene. That's the scene where he's actually driving. Which is another crazy reference that you would have no idea what that means.
Which he hated at the time. He was like, we don't need this joke. It's too in the moment, and it killed, right?
Because,
like,
people,
I didn't understand that joke at all.
Because you hadn't seen T2 in the time.
And so I watch it at this party with a bunch of other kids my age, and I'm like, they're all laughing. I'm like, why is that funny? And then somebody explains it to me at length, and I'm like, oh, I guess, sure. There's also a joke in the episode of Simpsons where Homer and Flanders become best friends, and Homer's chasing after the car, and it's like another T2 reference. And I really just needed to see T2. I needed to,
you really did.
I needed to not grow up in a fundamentalist religious environment. Like, that's sin one. We should have.
It's a little restrictive, it seems. Yeah. But what I was gonna say is, when they're getting the car fixed, and the guy who, I think his name is Phil, actually, who at the beginning they find on the park bench.
He's over partied,
and he looks like he's going to spew. So he works at the car shop, and they're pulling money out of their pockets as though they don't know how money works and, like, how numbers work. It's just, and it's a throwaway joke, because they keep going, like, more?
Not enough.
I don't know. There's something about that type of stuff where it's like they're finding jokes that, you know, you wouldn't find normally.
And I love that their intelligence varies from scene to scene. But I remembered my intro, so I'm gonna drop it in right here. And
perfect.
I'm your special guest host, Emily St. James, sitting in for your normal host, Senator Dianne Feinstein, who's all partied out. Please continue.
My God, that's incredible. She is all partied out. I would say so is Mitch McConnell.
What is she? Crullers, and what was the other thing you need? Stat?
Oh, yeah. Crullers.
Crullers and coffee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Crullers and coffee stat. Yeah. It's there's so many jokes that I love in this. Hi, I'm in Delaware. Like, why the blue screen does Delaware is fantastic. Right. It's just sort of it's filled with great jokes. Sometimes I wish I could boldly go where no one has gone before. I'll probably stay in Aurora. And that apparently was the last scene they shot, which is them at the airport when they're on the hood of the car and the airplane goes by. And there's sort of two scenes there. There's the one right. later when they kind of, and the last scene when they get annoyed with each other is the last scene they shot. And apparently it was because everyone was done with this fucking movie. Like wow. everyone was just like, we want to go home. Enough is enough.
So they shot the apology and the makeup scene before they shot the breakup scene. Cause yeah, that I literally missed it. I was like, wait, what? Yeah. I mean, I think I was talking really about Neil and I was like, oh yeah. wait, they yeah. made up.
No, I That's like, you missed it. He apologized. But I love the way this is just completely obliterated by the sound of the jet.
Correct. Correct. It, which is a good bit. I mean, I think that you guys mentioned this earlier with the Garth stuff, which is that he does feel sort of like he's these bridges between plot stuff, if that makes sense. You have him sort of, you have him giving that tour of Benjamin's apartment to camera where, excuse me, he finds the condoms and says ripped for her pleasure and goes, ew. Again, where they feel like children, like that's
a story point because he finds out the plot, but then thinks that it's not talking about him.
But it's just like that they're grossed, that he's grossed out by condoms is something a like 12-year-old would be. So right. there is this kind of weird infantile.
Well,
thing
yeah,
going on.
He does see. Yes, exactly. He there's definitely man child. You know, some might say maybe spectrum-y kind of Garth. You know,
there definitely
so,
is. Yeah.
So.
But he's also like, there's these moments where he's really heroic too, right? Where when he talks down Benjamin's right hand man with the flashlight,
yeah,
the arms
back to hold the friends back. If Benjamin were
flashlight.
An ice cream flavor, he'd be pralines and dick. I mean, like, there is something about Garth and his kind of, I don't even know, like his utility. In this movie that I just was really blown away by.
But I think that's sort of the hallmark of a great sketch player too.
Totally. Mm. Absolutely. Absolutely. There is obviously sort of this, I guess the story ultimately kicks into high gear in kind of the third act of this movie where Benjamin's looking to steal Cassandra. Maybe I'm not even sure he's all that into her, but it seems like he's doing it because the story's telling him to.
Yeah, it's very unclear why he's even interested in so specifically just in her at that moment.
Correct.
It's like, is he doing it because he doesn't like Wayne? It's
very strange.
I think a lot of great American comedies mm-hmm. that don't really seem to have stories are just actually about the absurdity of capitalism. And I think this sure. movie is that. This movie's like Wayne wants to buy a guitar. To buy the guitar, he has to like have a job. So he has to like sell out his TV show and like it's going to be sold to some old man who just keeps making money, even though he doesn't understand what the American public wants. But he's going to continue making money because he's already rich. Garth is like outside of this rubric. He doesn't care about money. He doesn't care about capitalism. And that's why he's kind of like the moral center of the movie in a weird way.
Yes.
And so like the movie doesn't need to have a plot because you're just tracing the absurdity of, well, Wayne wants a guitar. Now he's got a girlfriend. He's got to figure out a way to like keep her. And then this other guy's going to come in and just take everything because he can. He doesn't need a motivation, really. He's a capitalist.
It's true.
He could just come in and be like, I want this hot girl to be my girlfriend. And, you know, he's got a lot of money. So in theory, he's a real threat. It is, I don't know. I think it's kind of savvy on those grounds.
I agree.
One of the reasons it holds up.
And I do think also that like they don't shine a bright light on the breakup of the friendship. They kind of breeze past it because I don't think they think anyone's going to buy that they're really on the rocks because these two are so fused to one another. But you do have that moment where Garth is upset because Wayne basically fucks off and leaves him hosting the show. We don't actually see him hosting, which is kind of great. We just have the guy being like, remember when that guy's head exploded in Scanners and you just see Garth's face? So like
because he exists outside of capitalist expectations. He doesn't understand how to. I'm doing academia over here, Phil. I know what you're doing.
I mean listen I'm just holding on for dear life really at this point. But I
would have given the note that he should have lost Garth and Cassandra and the guitar.
Oh, that's a good note. Yeah,
that just would have been rock bottom. But
Or he has to like sell the guitar to get everybody back, something like that.
Something to that effect.
It seemed like it was going to be much more vital to the plot.
And it's not.
No.
He just buys it and gets it and everything is fine.
That's how capitalism works, Phil. You buy the thing, you get it, and everything's fine. You're never sad again.
What I do think is interesting, though, is so we're obviously talking about this film. We're talking about Newsies next week. And I bring this up just because Newsies somehow is a movie, a pro-union movie inside Disney about taking down the man and unionizing and striking, which is a movie that would never get made today as we sit in the middle of a writers and actors strike. I think it's interesting how this movie is also sort of anti-capitalist in terms of, you know, damn the man, all that kind of energy. And then even now, like, Barbie kind of rounds the edges off of that a little bit, right? Like, Mattel isn't really the villain in the movie. Like, Will Ferrell's kind of the villain, but then turns out to be a nice guy at the end. So it is interesting that, like, in 92, you were okay to kind of thumb your nose at these corporations and to that idea. And now you're very much not.
Well, that feels very, I mean, talk about Gen X. That was like just the whole thing with Gen X. Like, when did Reality Bites come out? It feels like
it was 95.
Right. I mean, because there's some crossover there too, in terms of, like, you know, when we looked at, like, oh, wow, selling out is like, you could not make a movie.
Selling out is the worst thing.
It's like, people are like, what are you talking
selling
about?
Selling out is the goal now.
Yeah.
Right. Which is part of, I mean, not to come back to Josie, but Josie is a little bit of that too, right? Like, definitely. I think there's definitely that energy of, like, don't sell out, that lingers into the early 2000s, but now you can't really get away with that.
No, now it's just about, you know, building your brand so you can sell out.
Well, there's no way to exist outside of big corporate media unless you are like a child of wealth. You know, you come from privilege. And you can just make your own stuff, you know, like, who are the artists working in film who are just consistently working on the outside of everything and making great, you know, they're mostly like documentarians. Occasionally you'll have like an Andrew Jarecki who can do that. But it's like, yeah, you know, to make these things, you need money. And increasingly you can only get money from people who are just making, you know, commercial IP product, and great stuff gets made within that system. But it is, yeah, selling out has no meaning anymore because everything has already, like, the system has sold itself out. There's no way to, yeah, writing a paper over here.
It is tough now. And I don't know if it's because the budgets seem so insane now, you know, where to make, I mean, I thought I'd love Barbie, but like, that is a $145 million budget on that movie. I mean, that's a lot of money. You know, part of it, I think, is the practicality of that film. I think that, you know, Greta made it such an important thing that she didn't want a lot of CG in the film and she wanted it all to be practical, which is ultimately more expensive. But still, like, a Wayne's World at $20 million price tag, right? Like, I'm sure Paramount's just like, yeah, sure, if you want to, like, make fun of corporate culture, whatever. But yeah, I mean, today it's just a lot harder to do that.
What would the budget be for Wayne's World 3 if they made it this year? Because you know that there's been those conversations. Yeah. It would be ridiculous.
It depends how much Mike wants up front, too.
Also true. Yeah. I mean, and by the way, was there a Wayne's World commercial or something that came out within the last?
Yeah, well, they reunited because, I mean, I had to read up on this last night, but they, you know, they hadn't spoken. You know, after the movie, they go their separate way. Well, after, I guess the sequel, they go their separate ways. Sure. And apparently, yeah, Mike didn't want Dana in the sequel, whatever it was. But then he goes on to do, you know, everybody that he goes on to do Austin Powers and Dr. Sure. Evil is based on the Lord Dana Carvey's Lorne Michaels. And Dana Carvey's really upset about it. And they don't really, they go their separate ways and talk until they did a Super Bowl commercial like 2 years ago as Wayne and Garth. And he said that really kind of, they mended fences and now they're good friends again.
Did that?
They put it behind them.
Did that come out of in COVID? They did all these like movie reunion things over Zoom, and one of them was Wayne's World. And I wonder if like that was the first time they talked.
They did an appearance on an award, like maybe the MTV Awards or something. They'd done. And they did at the SNL the 40th. They came back into the SNL 40th together as well, but it didn't. You know, they weren't close after that. They just kind of figured they did it, and there was still beef. That's but now they're okay.
Yeah, you know, I think that Mike Myers seems to be going through his own journey, you know, in terms of, he had that Netflix movie, what was it called? Did you see it, Emily? Where he played like a million characters or something?
Oh, God,
like that?
I don't remember at all. Like,
But it happened. It was a thing. And, you know, he's been threatening to do another Austin Powers. You know, and he shows up obviously in Inglourious Basterds.
The Pentaveret.
That's it. Ugh. There it is.
I loved him in Inglourious Basterds. I want to see him do more stuff like that. Just come in and do a character bit in somebody else's movie. B, I don't want to see another Austin Powers. I want to see another Wayne's World. Not just because of like my rough micro generation, but because of like there is something within Wayne's World about being too old for doing what you're doing, and that's inherent to the joke that is funnier when they're both like approaching extremely old age, as opposed to Austin Powers, where it's just like, yeah, he's still horny. You're like, okay, sure.
I think part of it, the thing too that I always forget is the Shrek of it all too.
Oh, right. Yeah, I forgot that too.
So he does that voice, which I assume makes him a bazillion dollars. And I, you know, obviously Cat in the Hat is a nightmare movie that is just, I mean, crazy that it exists. Love Guru, a disaster, obviously.
But wait, wasn't Cat in the Hat also like, because there was the whole Sprockets thing where they were supposed to make the Sprockets movie.
Yes.
And the director of that then got to do Cat in the Hat because, and
it was Beau Welsh who directed, who, you know, amazing production designer, married to Catherine O'Hara. So Cat in the Hat is just a truly nightmare fuel movie. Like, it's one of those things where you're just like, I don't understand how any of this happened, which is kind of the, you have to toe a line with the Seuss stuff. I'm not a big Ron Howard, Jim Carrey, Grinch movie. I don't think they should exist in human form.
I can't
believe Seuss stuff is very disturbing. It's just part, you start getting into like Uncanny Valley territory.
Yes.
It's like people shouldn't look like that.
That's exactly.
It's scary.
I can't believe that the Ron Howard Grinch has stance. And like, I haven't ever revisited it. I found it too disturbing. But like, I've been reading my child Green Eggs and Ham now. Sure, you know, they're at the age where they can appreciate that. And I guess 9 months is when you really are able to. But like, I just read that and the illustrations are so evocative and so sparse. And I'm just like, putting Seuss in any context other than animation, even the computer animated Grinch, it was like a little too detailed. You need that scratchy quality to it. Totally anyway, agree. I'm going to make a live action Green Eggs and Ham once this strike is over. I'm announcing it right
finally,
now.
You're finally going to get that off the ground. Yeah. I mean, this is all just to say that I think that Mike Myers right now is, I don't know, not really sure where he exists. And I imagine that that might've led a little bit back to Dana Carvey, and who knows, maybe I don't want to see a Wayne's World 3. Do you really want to see that?
I would love it. I think, like, here's the thing, it's probably a disaster, but I think there is something very funny about those guys still doing this, and at this point they'd be in their 50s, so I think there's something very funny about it.
I guess maybe there's something funny about it.
Like, it's a very hard needle to thread, but this movie's a very hard needle to thread.
Oh, here's the story.
You got the story, Deb?
The AMPTP comes to them during the strike for a program. They're fully out of things to air. We run out. We reach the end of television, and they have to resurrect them.
I do keep waiting for the AMPTP to go to, like, the American Movie guys from that movie. Just be like, hey, listen, we need Coven.
Yes,
we gotta see it.
Oh my god,
we need Coven. That's what people need. As another little time capsule from 92, which I think is kind of amazing, is so the music video that Cassandra is shooting, where like she's got this giant boa constrictor on and she's in the jungle and it's absurd, is actually a reference to a Pearl Jam music video for Even Flow that has never seen the light of day, that truly they were just like, we hate this so much, we are never making another music video again. Like, it literally was just, that was a breaking point for them. I would give anything to see the jungle Even Flow music video.
It for sure was a jungle, like it was a direct.
That's what they say. That's what they say.
Wow.
I mean,
who directed it?
That I don't know. I mean, that person probably is, you know,
admitting to it. Like one of three guys, right?
Well, sure, because that's the only people who were making music videos.
Or like Sam Bear. Like, I feel like Romantic. We can find out.
Yeah. It's like Mark Romantic did a jungle video with Pearl Jam.
He's a dad at my school. I'm gonna ask.
Well, he'll know who did it. He'll definitely know who did it at the very least.
I do think that the Dana Carvey thing is interesting as well, in terms of like his career just never fully connected.
Well, I think the year, it was either the same year or the year after Austin Powers blows up and becomes even bigger than Wayne's World. Actually, you know, I don't think it was bigger than Wayne's World. I think it kind of found its life on home video, but was still a hit. He makes Master of Disguise, which is supposed to be his movie that's going to show, you know, showcase his talents and doing all these, and it's just it killed his movie career essentially. His new podcast I'm enjoying now with David Spade.
Oh, is it? Oh, that
it's
sounds great.
Really good. It's really, really sweet, and it's really good. And I'm glad to listen to it.
his television show is also notorious in terms of having, you know, one of the greatest writing staffs that's ever been of comedy. And if people haven't watched the Hulu documentary about that television show, you should watch the Dana Carvey thing because it's amazing. It's all about the making of that show and how they they just were doing things they shouldn't do. And
well, they put it after Home Improvement. It was like the most vicious, satirical.
Home Improvement was my favorite show, and I watched the Dana Carvey show. Like, my love for Home Improvement was waning at that point in time. I think by then I was onto X-Files, which like changed my life. But like, but I still was watching Home Improvement. I watched the Dana Carvey show and was like, "What is this? This is interesting. This is fun." Yeah, I knew who he was because I'd seen Wayne's World, but.
It is, I mean, it's a crazy show, and it is also, you know, a symbol of what could get on the air back in the day and what kind of risks were taken by broadcast networks back then. But like, I mean, it's an insane thing. You had like a sketch of Bill Clinton with like numerous breasts feeding
puppies.
Goats.
puppies. Yeah, he's nursing puppies. Bill Clinton opens his shirt and he has teeth and he nurses puppies. And I think that was the opening sketch. I think people went from Home Improvement to
that.
What the fuck am I watching? And they literally just, you probably saw people turning off the television channel.
It's wonderful.
Like, I just, remember how Home Improvement ended with bloopers and it would be like Tim Allen coming in. Tim Allen would come in and be like, "Hey, Patricia, Jill." And then the audience go, "Oh," and you go from that to Bill Clinton nursing puppies. That's perfect. That's,
you know, good. The thing you're saying about Dana Carvey is there's some people who, like, he is a all-time great sketch player, but sometimes it's hard to just translate.
Oh yeah.
Like if I see you watch him in a movie and you don't want to see him play just one character. And there are other people that are like, for years, Martin Short was like that, you know, where he was the ultimate talk show guest, great on sketches, but he had a hard time figuring out how to turn that into like just one consistent character on a show or a movie. Sure. And I feel like there's some of the women on SNL that are like that too, where it's just like, I just want to see them do characters.
I was just going to ask, because it's, you know, looking at your films, and obviously you're making films a little bit later, so, you know, it's a different thing, but it is nice to see to a certain degree that you had a little bit more prominently female characters, you had more prominent female comedian characters, but like back in the early 90s, and Emily, we've talked about this obviously, and it's one of the reasons why you love this podcast, is there's just a real lack of strong female, you know, complex female characters. It's a real fucking bummer.
That's one reason I like Cassandra. Like, she's not like a complex character, but she has like a dimension, you know. She's allowed to have an implicit backstory. Sure. She's like really good at singing and doing rock and roll and all of that. And like, you know, she's more than just extremely hot. Like, she is extremely hot. You don't entirely buy that she's in love with Wayne, but you buy that she's a person who has her own interests. And that is often enough to like make a love story work in a movie like this, because you're like, oh, she has her own interests. Therefore, there must be something in her psychology that makes her like this guy.
It also speaks to, you know, we talked about how we recorded recently the Sister Act. I mean, that's why Whoopi is such a like lightning in a bottle type, you know, performer, where you're just like, holy shit, I want to see anything that this person is in. And there's just so few of those. I mean, obviously, you know, patriarchy and shittiness and whatever is part of the reason for that. But I also think that I also just don't think that, you know, a lot of female writers, female directors were being given shots back then. It's why I think that Penelope Spheeris of it all is also such an important thing. And it's so fucking disappointing to see that taken away from her because of ego and nonsense. I guess I'm curious as to what you guys sort of, how you, you know, you both went to film school together, correct?
Different years, but yeah, we were there at the same time.
And sort of how, what was it like trying to sort of break in and sort of looking at the landscape of film in sort of the, you know, mid to late 90s?
I mean, to be fair, I'm not sure I would have gotten anywhere on my own. I think it, you know, I still remember, like, we had to go in front of the board at the DGA to lobby to get co-director credit, which they just did not give out back then.
Really?
Wow. And, I can't,
but the DGA seems like such a wonderful organization. I find that shocking to hear.
They were so female friendly at the time. No, look, they've really gone, you know, there's obviously, it's a very different time now. Yeah. But we were in a room full of men. You know, Walter Hill was there. I
think Robert Wise.
Robert Wise might have been there.
Wow. Director of the editor of Citizen Kane.
And we had to stand up there and speak of why we felt we should deserve this and what our history was together. And I cannot remember the man's last name, but it was Elliot. And I'll figure it out at some point. But he looked at me and he said, "She's so cute, I'd let her do anything." Like, that was my pass, you know? And I dressed down as well. Cool. I still remember I was wearing like a hoodie. It was zipped all the way up and like big jeans and like boots. And like the takeaway was like, she's adorable. Let her try.
Jesus Christ. That's great. Jeez. I
am imagining this like a Supreme Court hearing though. Like they're all on like a really
It felt like it.
I think Paris Barkley was there.
It definitely felt like it. And we also saw them brutally. I think it was maybe Adam Rifkin was trying to get them to allow him to put his credits at the end of the movie. And they had a rule at the time, and I think they still do, where if there's any name at the front of the movie, like a production company has a person's name in it, all the credits have to go at the front of the movie. The director credit has to stay up there. And they said no. They were like, no, you can't do it. You have to, because he had this oneer. He wanted to preserve this oneer without credits in front of it. They were like, no, the credits have to be in the front. If there's any name, the director's name has to be there too. We were like, oh shit, they're really hard. They're tough.
My hoodie turned him around, man.
But at the time, you know, look, you're talking early 90s when we broke in. There were so many movies being made. Like, it seemed like everybody we knew was selling a screenplay. It was like, the development money that they were buying scripts, they were buying spec scripts and developing movies. They developed like 10 movies for every one that they'd make, and they were making hundreds. So it was just, it was so much, I'm not going to say it was like really easy, but it was so much easier than it is now to break in and sell something on the movie side, especially.
Right.
Because they needed scripts. They needed content. So they didn't call it content back then. Back then it was movies.
But was Can't Hardly Wait hard to get on its feet? Or are you saying it was?
Aside from that incident at the DGA, no.
Because what happened was we had done well as writers. We were working on a bunch of different scripts and different movies that actually got made. And we kind of felt like, all right, it's time for us to direct something. We were a little frustrated. We'd gotten rewritten a couple of times and said, let's control the presses. Let's write something. So we wrote a script that we knew we could kind of, if we had to, we could shoot over a weekend at a house. And then Scream came out right when we finished the script. And suddenly every studio wanted a teen movie. And we had one. And it was so cheap. I mean, it was under $10 million, really contained. And it was like, it was a no-brainer. They had Betty Thomas come on to produce. So she kind of backstopped us as first-time directors, which made it even easier to say, like, we want to direct it. And it felt like everybody we knew was like, oh, I'm directing a movie too. I've got a movie getting made. It really felt like that. And then that all came to a screeching halt.
Yeah. It's pretty fascinating how I remember seeing Can't Hardly Wait on a Date. I remember I think it was a pretty big like high school date movie, if I'm not mistaken. And watching it again the other day, I was like, man, those the needle drops, just every single one of them took me like right back to 1998. Like it's pretty incredible to watch. The cast is incredible. There's so many 6 Feet Under cast members in that movie. It's unbelievable. I don't know why that is.
And I don't know that Alan Paul was a huge Can't Hardly Wait fan or if it's a casting director. Watching 6 Feet Under is like, oh, wow, there's somebody else from our movie.
It's like how Christopher Nolan keeps using 10 things I hate about you people. And you're like, is he just like going through the list? Is he going to get to Alyssa or Larissa Elena? Because I'm here for
Julia Stiles any day now, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's got to happen. Like
it's got to happen. It's crazy, yeah.
I had big Jennifer Love Hewitt and Can't Hardly Wait energy in high school. And my wife had big Lauren Ambrose. So I think there needs to be a Lego sequel where there are a couple. Like, let's just make that happen.
I will say, though,
better than any of the sequel ideas we've been pitched to this time, I can tell you.
Jennifer Love Hewitt's hair in that movie is something else. Like her, it's she's also so petite that it just makes it look so much bigger on top of everything. But she's really good. Everyone's good in that movie.
There were pieces, wasn't it? No, there were pieces.
But she wanted that.
We had to, like, that was an expense that, like, we had to, like, cough up for. She wanted the pieces in the hair.
She felt very strongly that that prettiest girl in school just always had the greatest hair. Like, so she was like, I just want like this just beautiful big hair. So yeah, so we added to her, and it was kind of a character character in its own.
I was really kind of blown away watching it. I have not watched it in a really long time. I've obviously watched Josie many times, but just because I think that Josie is fantastic. But I was Josie harder to get made?
No. No, I wish I could say it's a struggle, but no, I mean, the truth is we passed on it twice. You know, the Universal came to us with this idea and said, you know, what do you think of this? We were like, oh, that sounds terrible. Like, with Josie, the pussy gets what? And then, and it wasn't until we realized, like, oh, wait a minute, they're going to let us make a studio musical. Like, this could be a musical. Right. They're going to let us make an actual musical at a studio. And then we started seriously considering it. And then, you know, we turned it. Actually, I think the original thing we pitched may have had an outer space element. And then we were like, that's terrible. That's crazy. And then we went back with what we did. And yeah, they kind of were excited about it. And
can you please make a sequel to Josie in Space? I mean, I think you could get all the players back.
Yeah. Listen,
Deb's face does not seem like she wants to be doing.
No, I was thinking, like, I don't even think. I think the rights are so tangled now because of happened with Riverdale that, like, I don't even think you could.
Listen, if you make Josie and the Pussycats in Space, and like Jennifer Love Hewitt and Lauren Ambrose are there, and they're a lesbian couple, that sounds great.
Yeah, can you bring these two universes together? It seems pretty obvious at this point.
The Can't Hardly Pussycats universe.
It is. I mean, listen.
I think you just might want to get a cameo with the two of them together, and that might satisfy.
That might be easier at this point.
Yeah.
But you're. I mean, yeah. It's a really special movie, and I do think that Wayne's World feels like it broke a lot of ground to kind of let a lot of these comedies happen. Did you guys? I mean, at the end of this film, they do this kind of Scooby-Doo kind of multiple endings. They give us like a super sad ending where you have this amazing shot of Wayne carrying Garth out of the ashes of the house that's like gone with the wind. That's just incredible. After an electrical fire starts and he loses Cassandra and it all goes to shit. Then you have the Scooby-Doo ending that we mentioned where they rip off the face and it's Mr. Withers. Old Man Withers, that is. And then the mega happy ending is Cassandra gets a record contract, rekindles a relationship with Wayne. Garth begins a relationship with the waitress he's fantasized over. And Benjamin is reformed and learns that money and good looks are not necessarily what bring you happiness. But then you also have like post-credit stuff. And I'm trying to remember, and I don't know if you know this, Emily. What was the first movie to do post-credits? I know Ferris has a bit at the very end.
I'm sure it predates Ferris, but like, yeah,
it feels like an 80s thing.
Ferris feels like the first thing that people really notice. I'm going to Google this right now. Okay, that's my job on this podcast, just Googling things.
You're very good at it. But
Ferris is the one that I remember the most that landed with me the most. Yeah.
Well, because him just being like, it's over. Go home. Why are you still here?
It was one of those towels. Nobody's done that before.
Yeah. Fortunately. Yeah. There is a Wikipedia page about this, Phil. post-credit scenes may have their origin in encores, an additional performance added to the end of stage shows in response to audience applause. Opera encores were common practice. The first general release film to feature a post-credit scene is The Silencers, released in March 1966. The scene depicts the lead character, Matt Helm, played by Dean Martin, lying shirtless on what appears to be a rotating sofa along with 10 scantily clad women. He kisses two women before rubbing his face and muttering, "Oh my God." During the scene, text overlays read "coming up next" and "Matt Helm meets Lovey Craves It." Actually, this is one. This is the one I remember. Muppet Movie has a big post credit. Not a big one, but it has a post credit scene. Sure. That's the one that I always think.
I want someone to reenact the Dean Martin one at some point, like a Marvel movie just does that. Just
you can put that in Josie and the Pussycats in Space, like that. Yeah.
Lauren Ambrose and Jennifer Love Hewitt will be on that sofa.
exactly.
Perfect. I'll just say this though, in terms of the end of this movie, as we're wrapping this up, I do think that like. The multiple ending thing, they wrap the movie up quite quickly, but it is satisfying and it is kind of meta and it does feel as though it's kind of acknowledging everything that came before it. It's also satisfying. It also feels like there's no sequel really to be had here. Like, I know why they did it. I get why they did it. And it's not a terrible movie by any means, but I remember very little of it. I remember Wayne Stock and Aerosmith and a Jurassic Park joke. And
oh, so they got Aerosmith for the sequel.
Yeah.
Because that's what you read, that Aerosmith turned down. That's why they got Alice Cooper. For the sequel.
They paid them more, probably, is my guess.
Interesting. Or they realized it was a big
hit. Yeah, I mean, the Alice Cooper thing in this is great. I also read that Alice Cooper only thought he was going to have like a cameo. Didn't realize he was going to have like a monologue about indigenous people. And then on the day they gave him the monologue and he just learned it on the day and wow. just did it then there.
No cards, just
no cards. Just did it. That's I mean, it's amazing. But yeah, he gives a whole speech about Milwaukee.
That is my favorite. But I keep saying things are my favorite. That's my favorite. I love that.
Great scene.
I just remember thinking that was so funny when I was however old I was when I first saw this. I was just like, yeah, that's good. That, you know,
that's good.
Yeah. And the Chris Farley thing, bit. Chris Farley. I was just like, yeah, especially when they call back to it and they're like, good thing that guy knew all this oddly specific information.
This is self-evidently
one of the greatest films ever made. Like, let's just admit it.
It is. I mean, I just feel like, and listen, there's obviously jokes that don't age well, not jokes in particular, where you're just like, I guess this was a thing at a moment.
I do wonder, like, is was not ever meant to be actually funny, or was it meant to be like, you know, ironically funny? Was it meant
a lot of these things were from the sketch. You know, I feel like some of the things they had to, like, we got to do that with, like, the hooked in, you know, it was all in the sketch. So they had to get those in the movie and not, I think, was from the sketch. And I think it played.
I still don't get the fish thing. Can someone explain to me?
It was the thing where it was like when they tricked somebody. They tricked somebody. And it was like, we got you. Yeah, fished in, hooked, whatever. That was the sketch. And then they literally waited for the last joke in this movie. Yeah, they had to wait for the end to fit it in. Phil, I think it played. They had to play the hits.
I guess. Yes.
Phil, you know what a fish is, right? And like how sometimes people catch fish and then eat them.
Sure.
Yeah, great.
Yeah. But
that's
okay. But that's a joke?
Yeah, fish exist. It's funny.
Sure. Some of the stuff works better. Most of it works better than the fish joke. But it is all to say that, like, watching it again, I was surprised by how well it worked. Like, I was worried when I hit play that I was like, okay, so I'm really going to watch this movie and is it going to hold up? And I think that it really did. Like, I think it's got a pretty big heart. I think that it's you know, it's not cynical. I think that so many comedies now are pretty jaded and cynical. And I think that this movie feels just really lovely in a weird way. Which I was kind of not expecting. And I think part of it is, you know, the Wayne and Garth relationship is obviously kind of the beating heart of the movie. I do think though, in the research I did, apparently Mike Myers, the first note he gave to Dana Carvey before they did the sketch was, I want to quote him accurately so I don't quote it improperly, but basically he said to him that all Garth cares about is that he thinks that Wayne is the coolest person in the world. Myers told Carvey that Garth is the guy who really worships Wayne and that's his main thing. It comes through
in this movie. You can tell. No, I like realize how much of my delivery is like, hi everybody, I'm Garth. What's up? Like,
there's a little bit of Garth in you.
Yeah, I just somehow my teenage brain just like that trickled in.
There's even like when after you guys mentioned earlier the Ed O'Neill moment, right? And Wayne says the only person who talks to the camera is me or Garth. Then the camera turns to Garth. He's like, I don't have anything to say. What's that? And then you hear him go, ooh. He's crying as he's running away from the camera. There's just something really adorable about Garth. He's great.
He speaks to all the part of us who's, I'm also here.
Right. And also, like, that could feel like a sidekick, right? Like, that could feel very kind of like, I'm an appendage to Wayne. But I think it's a testament to Dana Carvey that they do feel like they're on even footing. Like, I never feel as though Garth is, you know, it's more like the Abbott to his Costello, if that makes sense. Like, they do feel like they are a pair, which I think
And that scene on the car does, to me, that was kind of the most effective scene, the laugh that they do, the laugh that Mike Myers does and that they share seems so, it's so weird that that was the last scene that they hate each other. It's so genuine. Like in a movie where it's like they're breaking the fourth wall and it's bit after bit, it felt
is
so.
That the Bugs Bunny line?
Yeah. Yeah.
The but you know, do you know why that is though?
Why?
Is Dana told a joke. This, it was B-roll. He told a joke that got Mike Myers laughing.
Yeah.
So the laugh was so pure that they then inserted the Bugs Bunny joke, which
it works,
I mean,
so well.
It works really well because, I mean, it does. I don't know. I don't. The whole Bugs Bunny when he dresses up like a girl thing. Well, is that a different character? Because I know that there was like a girl. Emily, I wonder if you know the answer.
Oh, no, there is like Lola, you're talking about Lola.
Bunny. I'm talking about Lola.
Bugs Bunny often would.
Bugs Bunny
dress
isn't
up
drag,
as a lady bunny.
Yeah.
To fool Elmer Fudd.
Yeah.
Okay.
You had Looney Tunes in Canada, right, Phil?
Yes, Emily, I just don't know it as well as maybe I should.
All
I'm sorry.
It's confusing because they call them money loonies. So
well,
because
then
like,
in Space Jam, there's Lola, right? Like there's an actual female.
Yeah, but
bunny.
She's new for Space Bunny, Space Jam. Like she was invented for that.
I just wasn't sure
and,
if that
no,
was
no, and Bugs, Bugs, yeah, Bugs would dress and drag. That's the thing about Bugs is he's a gender fluid icon. When
Bugs
I did it,
best. I'm not.
I did a thing a few years ago where I would talk with my former editor's like child about different movies. I was the critic at large. We called her the critic at small, and she thought Bugs Bunny was a girl because Bugs Bunny dressed up in drag so often. And I was like, yes, Bugs Bunny. Now she, her. We gotta respect
I don't,
that.
I mean, I don't say this with. I guess. Do you feel as though Bugs gives off a gender?
No, he's. I think the reason that it works is because Bugs is just like he exists outside of gender. You
he's
know,
whatever he wants to be.
Yeah, we use pronouns for him because you know, of course, but like he's just like. Yeah, unlike a lot of cartoon characters, he seems to exist outside of all societal expectations,
the
which
best.
Is what's so fun about him. And, you know,
he's a stinker.
He's a stinker.
He has no pants on. I see there's no genitalia. You know, Mickey
it's
has
true.
Pants. That's clearly
that's
like
true.
Covering up Mickey's, you know,
yeah.
junk.
Mickey.
When he's sued by Disney by implying that Mickey
I don't think that Iger listens to this podcast. I think we're okay. But
if listen. He does, I got some words for him.
Yeah, I was going to say, Iger, if you're listening, back to the fucking negotiation table, please. But listen, I think this movie held up incredibly well. At the end of our podcast, we do a rating. So I'm curious, 0 to 99.
Oh, can before we do that, can I read
please?
The list of the 9 episode
Absolutely.
Titles of The Low Files, the show
yes.
where Rob Lowe and his sons chased ghosts?
Absolutely.
These are the
Absolutely.
9. This was canceled. It aired in 2017. It was canceled. The 9 episode titles are Haunted Boys Reformatory, The Secret Underwater Base, Bigfoot, Alien Abduction, Fear. Those are pretty normal titles.
Yeah.
America's Secret Space Program, Mind Games, The Wood Apes. And it's all about the journey. The Lows reflect on their journey over the past 8 weeks. The season finale of The Low Files is just like a clip show.
Wait, did you see all of them though, Emily?
No, I think I watched the first, like they came to TCA. And so I watched the first one to just like be able to ask questions. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this is kind of fun, but also I don't know why this exists. And like,
sure.
It appears
Didn't
you can't watch
it. Did he have a
new
show with his son? A Netflix show with one of
yes,
his sons?
Yes, that was a scripted show.
That was scripted, right?
Sons.
Yeah. I guess I appreciate that he wants to keep working with his kids.
No matter how good that show might have been, you got to earn a clip show. You can't have a clip show after 7 episodes.
Listen, I think we should all watch The Low Files and do a podcast about The Low Files.
I'm waiting for a
Can I just wait to the clip show? Can I just watch the highlights
yeah.
show? And then
not
have to...
I mean, it's something. So basically what we do at the end of this podcast is we rate the films from 0 to 99, 0 being the lowest, obviously 99 being the highest. We rate it from when we saw it originally and now what we think of it. So I'll go first. In 92, I mean, I adored this movie. I give it a 95. Like this movie just ripped for me as a kid. It still really holds up. I went down a little bit. I went to 92, but I think this movie, I mean, and that's basically just because there's some jokes that just didn't land for me this time around as I'm a little older, but I adore this film. Emily, where are you on the scale?
I mean, when I first saw this, I only gave things 0 or 99 as a kid.
Sure.
I gave this a 99 easily. When I first saw it, I would probably, of the movies we've talked about on this show outside of Aladdin, I think this is the one I saw the most growing up. Now, you know, as I said, it's self-evidently one of the greatest films ever made. So I got to go like 87, you know.
Where does it fall on the queerphobic scale?
Oh, I haven't done that in a few episodes, have I? Hmm.
You didn't do that for Sister Act, so if you want to retroactively.
Remember, there's the whole anal cavity search gag.
Yeah, that's the thing, is this movie is constantly doing jokes that should be more queerphobic than they are.
Yes.
Like the I love you man joke, right. Seems like it's going to be a joke about gay stuff, but then at the end,
but
it's
seems like wholehearted, doesn't it?
Yeah, at the end, some guy's like, and I've learned that you can express, two men can express platonic, and I'm just like, they veered away from the thing that would have been. So I got to give it like a 3. Like there is stuff, and you're always like on edge, but it never, you know, I mean, the anal cavity joke is another one where you're like, oh, that could be so much worse. It's literally just about, probably that would suck, you know? So I'm giving it a 3. And Sister Act, I'm also giving a 3 because some of the nuns should have been lesbians. It just should have happened.
I mean, I think some of them were, quite frankly. I mean, but that's just what it is. Okay, so Harry, where does this fall for you?
I think at the time, I mean, it's hard to remember. I remember really loving the sketch, and I think I really loved the movie. I'm gonna say like maybe a 92 in 92.
Sure. Yep.
Now it was hard to. I was so distracted by the fact. Again, it was all of the knots and the. It just didn't play as well now. It kind of has been spoiled by time. I'm gonna give it a now. 75, 74.
Oh, okay.
It definitely dropped since then for me.
What about you, Deb?
I'm going to go complete opposite. I'm going to say when I saw it the first time, it smacked of like bro culture to me. It did not. I felt a little bit like this movie was not for me.
Interesting.
So I think then I would have said around 80, 85.
Mm-hmm.
But now speaking about it and really talking about like, you know, I mean, I think there's a, you know, the contributions it made to comedy, clearly, like, we drew from it, even if we didn't know we were drawing from it. I'm going to take it back up to a 94.
Love it. Love it. I can't thank you guys enough for doing this, truly. I know that, like, it's just such a thrill having watched recently and talked about Chasing the Pussycats for over 2 hours. It's such a thrill to be able to talk with you guys about this movie, and I just thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you. This was fun.
Thanks for having us.
Lovely. Thank you.
Talk to you later. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Podcast Legends. Podcast Legends. 1992. Podcast Legends. Podcast Legends. 1992.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.